Dear son, my teacher in his goodness said, we now approach the city known as Dis, its teeming crowds and wealthy citizens. Already, sir, I said, I clearly can make them out, the minarets beyond the moat, as bright and red it seems, as if they sprang from fire, eternal fire, he answered me. Burning within, projects as you can see, these glowing profiles from the depths of hell. We now arrived within the deep-dug ditch, the channel round that place disconsolate, whose walls, it seemed to me, were formed of iron. Welcome, everyone, to the second part of the three-part episode on the Inferno. If there are any technical difficulties this evening, I do apologize. I have been having quite a few in setting this up, but I will endeavor to go ahead regardless. That, taken from Canto 8, is referring to Dante's transition between Circle 5 to Circle 6 and entering the hellscape, that is the City of Dis. The City of Dis is going to form quite a large part of the discussion because in terms of its imagery and its representation, I find the allegory of Dis and the idea of its counterpart in Pandemonium particularly evocative. Indeed, the episode is called Inferno. It is not called Dante's Inferno, albeit Dante is the most prominent aspect of this discussion. Inferno in the sense that this is very much a scriptural and literary analysis of hell in the medieval and the early modern mindset. And so I will be using many references to Milton's Paradise Lost. Indeed, the thumbnail that you can see this evening is indeed John Martin's 1841 Pandemonium. And in that spirit, I'm going to be reading several articles, the first of which is Dante's Gates of Dis and the Heavenly Jerusalem by Denise Heilbronn. All of the citations for the reading segments for this evening can be found in the description. Among the many theories concerning the identity of the one sent from heaven to open the gate of Dis for Dante, the pilgrim, those in particular need to be indicated whose direction is followed in the study. In 1929, Eric Auerbach designated the figure striding over the water with dry feet as a divine messenger, perhaps Il Vetro. However, in a later, more detailed analysis of the heavenly rescuer, whose descent he compared with that of the Homeric god Poseidon, Auerbach described the former unhesitatingly as a godlike figure. He represents the figure of Christ and symbolizes Christ's descent into hell, the harrowing. The interpretation which gives rise to the present one is Mark Moose's more far-reaching Advent at the Gates. Here, the rescuer's descent is recognized as a reenactment of the harrowing of hell, and this in turn is considered symbolic of the first Advent within a larger pattern of allegories in the Divine Comedy, representing the three Advents of Christ, the first and final Advents at the Gate of Dis and in the earthly paradise respectively, and an intermediary daily coming in grace in the Valley of Princes. If the allegory of the Inferno in the ninth canto is interpreted from this point of view, it becomes possible not only to discover reminiscences of the harrowing of hell, but also to demonstrate that the pilgrim's entrance into the City of Dis is surrounded by the symbolism of the First Advent. As that event is more commonly understood, the pictures I have on display at the moment are, on the left, John Martin's Pandemonium and Stradanus's Dis on the right. Entrance into the City of Dis is surrounded by the symbolism of the First Advent, as the event is more commonly understood, the incarnation, or the descent of the Saviour into the world. Moreover, the setting, the poetic language, as well as the dramatic action at the Gate of Dis are capable of suggesting the widest implications of the Advent. The coming of the Messiah was necessitated by the fall, and its promise will be fulfilled at the Last Judgment. Considered a central event in time, therefore, the First Advent leads a deeper significance to past history, as seen in retrospect, present and future history. On the other hand, it is a time of expectation, To reflect these aspects of the Advent in poetry, Dante uses a complex system of polysemy, involving the adaptation of traditional symbolism derived from patristic scriptural exegesis, i.e. inference from the scriptures and interpretation. Yet the literal narrative is never made subservient to the poet's allegorical intentions. Rather, it is imbued with the very drama of the Advent which inspires it. Again, an explicitly Catholic and Christian reading into this, in the same way that Virgil, as the virtuous pagan, and Dante are in some way mimicking a desacralized version of Christ's descent in the harrowing. The poet's address to the reader calls for an allegorical interpretation of the event that climaxes and resolves the entire episode at the Gate of Dis, the descent of one who is expected, who reopens the closed gate so that the pilgrim may proceed on his journey to salvation. But the stage is prepared for a major allegory, even before the poet explicitly alerts the reader to its imminence. Certain aspects of the usually well-defined setting of hell are deliberately obscured, and the principal actors in the scene, Virgil and Dante, behave in unexpected ways. The walls of Dis are located in a place set apart from the surrounding, otherworldly landscape by its distinct physical and spiritual atmosphere. Unlike the landscape of the Inferno 1, Canto 1, which occupies a moral space, completely lacking in geographical points of reference, except perhaps the wood, the setting of Cantos 8 and 9 does belong to the concretely defined topography of a hell. And yet, it has its particular moral dimension. The walls separate the fifth from the sixth circle of hell, but are not in either circle. They divide upper hell from the lower pit, and contain a gate, the second gate, on the pilgrim's journey, through which access to the city must be gained. As a point of passage, this gate, therefore, has a special solemnity. It is reached by way of the fog enshrouded Styx, whose exact spatial extent is never disclosed. Nevertheless, the wayfarers' circuitous movements along and across the water convey a sense of vast distance and breadth. After having circled the swamp on a wide foot in the wide arc, they notice some far-off tower signals which hint at its expanse. No sooner has Virgil responded to his pupil's questions about the meaning of the flames than Phlegas comes in his boat out of the fumes at the speed of an arrow. He ferries the travellers across, following, as one learns much later, a wide circular trajectory. This takes considerable time, for during the crossing, the meeting with Filippo Argenti takes place. In fact, the wrathful spirit is submerged and left behind even before the opposite shore comes into view. The travellers finally disembark at a gate, which, as the reader learns, is the next canto, is in a tower. Although it was possible to assume that the gate must be in a tower, as are medieval city gates, the question arises belatedly whether this tower might not be the very same one mentioned briefly at the end of Canto 7, the one whose tower signal flames were sighted from afar. If not, where was the tower at whose foot the wayfarers arrived at last? But even a careful reading of the text provides no ready answer to these questions. The vagueness surrounding the signal's tower location contributes considerably to the blurring of spatial configurations of the setting in which the allegory unfolds. Space is treated very much as a function of time, but time and duration are indicated only in relative terms. The tower is reached in the end. Phlegas will have the travellers no longer than during the crossing, Filippo submerged before the city comes into view. Thus the reader is imperceptibly transported out of the clearly delineated landscape of hell into a spiritual zone where a unique event takes place. At the gate, the pilgrim meets an obstacle that cannot be overcome by usual means of Virgil's guidance, but requires extraordinary divine intervention. Here, Virgil all but despairs of the journey, although he has foreknowledge of one who is to come in aid, and Dante is tempted to turn back. All this happens in a watery, foggy environment, set off by the glow of fire, where nothing can be distinctly visualized except for the city's ferruginous walls and the gate tower with its fiery top. So having set all the sort of thematic elements, indeed the idea of this being in some way comparable to the harrowing of hell and Christ's descent, I want to bring this over with the specific emphasis again on descent and salvation and the image of the tower specifically to another article, Anthony Lowe's The Image of the Tower in Paradise Lost, which, as you can see, evokes very much the same metaphors, allegory, and symbolism. Like Satan's pandemonium, the Tower of Babel in Paradise Lost, with its upward striving, symbolizes man's pride and marks his attempts to equal God and recreate reality. The Church Fathers assigned to this meaning and also pointed out the resemblance of the episode to the classical myth of the Titans when they revolted against the gods, the ending of the Titanomachy and their imprisonment in Tartarus. The tower is an archetypal image. It had traditionally embodied man's aspirations, his glory, and his ultimate transience. Milton uses the tower on several levels in the poem. The heavenly towers are unfallen originals. The earth and hellish are derivative perversions. The tower is closely connected with the temple, the city, and the court. It is often linked to Satan and suggests his pride, his overweening ambition, and his final downfall. Often, it has a proplectic force, ominously foreboding disaster. As an image, it implies an arc of motion, physical and moral, first up and then down, the opposite of the death-rebirth motif of patterns of humiliation and the conquest that is centered in the sun, which moves first down then up. The many individual towers, images, and Paradise Lost subtly interact. Finally, the tower becomes the most important compact symbol of rising and falling in the poem. At either end of Paradise Lost stands a building that symbolizes a culmination of the drive of evil to rival God and construct its own version of reality. Pandemonium is the fallen angel's answer to the heaven, the correlative of the longing for hellish glory, honor, power, and splendor. In Book 12, the building of the Tower of Babel by Nimrod marks a culmination of man's evil energies during the interregnum between the two Adams. From the time of Babel, dispersion onwards. Although evil persists, emphasis shifts to the rising forces of good in Abraham, Isaac, Joseph, Moses, who prepare the way for the coming of Christ. Thus the tower marks a crucial turning point in Milton's sweeping history of man, since the bricks of the tower are cast from the black bituminous gurge that boils out from underground the mouth of hell. A parallel with Pandemonium is immediately suggested. The two infernal buildings are brother parodies of the constructive power of good, though Satan's has the primacy. The essence of the parody is the symbolism of upward aspiration inherent in the tower, which connects with the whole metaphor of upward and downward movement in the poem. The raising of the tower begins, thus parallels with monumental concreteness, Satan's pride, his presumptuous flight, up through chaos, Eve's dream of flying, or man's attempts to become God. The Tower of Babel is a traditional symbol of man's impious pride. The father liked to use it as an illustration of man's most outrageous desire to set himself up in rivalry with his maker. Milton's use of it symbolizes the culmination of evil among men. It is therefore not unusual that Eusebius exemplifies in his ecclesiastical history the orthodox view of Babel's meaning after the fall of man. Lived like savages, the cruel creatures destroying natural reason and the germs of thought and civilization, by the excess of their self-chosen wickedness, giving themselves over entirely to all manner of iniquity. So, as at one time to corrupt one another, at another, to kill one another and gain to eat human flesh, to venture on the battles with God and on to battles with giants, even to plan to fortify the earth against heaven, and by the madness of a perverted mind to prepare war against the supreme God himself, so combined to Dante's conception of the fixity of hell and that it essentially is encapsulate of all the corruptions and vices of men, or in Dante's case specifically, those that fall below the sins of incontinence. With Milton, it transcends into an object of ambition. Thus, the construction of the tower marks the absolute extremity of perversion and wickedness. Worse than murder, war, or cannibalism as an expression of hubris, the building of the Tower of Babel is also paralleled in classical myth, especially in the revolt of the Titans or the Giants, the Gigantes or the Titanomachy, if one sort of goes back and I try to remember my Greek mythology, against the gods. The similarity was recognized by early Christian commentators, such as St. Justin, the martyr. Indeed, the Tower of Babel, as Milton knew, has the qualities of a universal myth, with all the resonance and emotional suggestiveness that characterize symbols of this kind. Indeed, the purpose of me really discussing Dante's Inferno in the first place and reading into this, which again sort of goes beyond the realms of conceptual history into that of comparative mythology. But although Babel symbolizes the most perverse kind of sinfulness, like many of the upward movements and strivings in Paradise Lost, the overweening pride that creates it is comically humbled. There is laughter in heaven at the expense of the builders, like the earlier at Satan, for the tower, instead of tragically falling, is dissolved into a cacophonous ridicule. Forthwith, a hideous gabble rises loud among the builders, each to other calls. Not understood till hoarse and all in rage, us mocked they storm, great laughter was in heaven. And looking down to see the hubbub strange, and hear us the din, thus was the building left, ridiculous and the work's confusion named. Although the outcome is fixed by the Bible, Milton develops the picture with an obvious relish. St. Jerome has suggested that God's decision was to disperse instead of destroy the builders, and that was merciful, because it gave them the chance to repent individually. Milton, if he knew this interpretation, does not make use of the chance to further justify the ways of God to men. He had shown a similar scorn for Babel's builders in an earlier book, where he placed them with the embryos and idiots, eremites and friars in the paradise of fools. Their attempt to rival God thus is too in vain in Milton's eyes to merit, even to merit hell. Paradise Lost, however, characteristically, combines tragedy with comedy and poignancy with ridicule. Although the Tower of Babel ends in confusion, the human passions that go into its building are tragic. The tyranny, oppression, and slaughter of men remain the motif of the tower in itself, the basically tragic, its rise and fall, an old image of pride and catastrophe. The towers of Troy, for example, conventionally represented human grandeur and evanescence after Homer and Virgil. Marlowe's, was this the face that launched 1,000 ships and burnt the topless towers of Ilium, was repeated again and again to illustrate the theme of Ubi Sunt. Milton would have known Spencer's image. The tower, which naturally embodies the movement of rise and fall, is also the very essence of the city and of the works and of the aspirations of man. It conveys both the glory and its transience. So, for example, in Shakespeare, in King John II, or King John rather, sorry, "How majesty, how high thy glory towers when the rich blood of kings is set on fire." That these great towers and trophies and schools should fall, and in the tempest, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, ye all which it inherit shall dissolve, and like the insubstantial pageant faded, like not a rack behind. Two of Milton's earlier poems echo conventionally this theme of the transience of human glory. In The Passion, he asks to be transported where the towers of Salem stood, once glorious towers now sunk in guiltless blood. Here the appeal to the tradition is merely perfunctory. But there is genuine feeling in the image when it appears near the close of Sonnet 8. The great Emathian conqueror bid spare the house of Pindarus when temple and tower went aground. Two responses are therefore possible to the tower. imagining the downfall of worldly greatness, it retains some of its Christian or secular weight, though long used as a Christian argument against worldliness. In this aspect, it evolves a primarily tragic emotion, pity for the fool rather than satisfaction in its justice. As an image for foolish presumption, however it can be evoke, how can it invoke indignation, scorn, and laughter, which are primarily the responses to comedy? Turning from bubble to pandemonium, for example, one finds a more serious and complex attitude. The construction of hell's capital, though foolish and vain, is associated with the tragedy of man's worldly efforts to heap up wealth and luxury, to build splendid but corrupt cities, courts, and temples. Nor great Al-Cairo, such magnificence, equaled all in the glories to enshrine Belus or Serapis, their gods, or seat the kings when Egypt and Assyria strove in wealth and luxury, compared to Babylon. Two of Earth's great empires, now fallen and gone, strive against each other, revealing their desire to excel. The emulation is also directed against God. Belus and Serapis rival him, as well as each other. This striving emphasizes the pride that is the fundamental force behind worldly glory. It corresponds with Satan's drive to be the first and highest. Interestingly, the word occurs again when Milton glances at the pagan paradises that emulate Eden. The beauty of the passage, its counterlogical value, which has been demonstrated, but not the parallel of Pandemonium or Babel. In it, Milton describes yet another competition by the pagan world to equal or surpass God, not in power and glory, but in beauty, far more than Al-Cairo and Babylon. These are other gardens, evoke a positive response. Nevertheless, they too are only distortions of the true paradise, rumors and empty dreams. Like other images, Milton uses the tower to describe heaven as well as earth and hell. Some critics have protested that this apparently indiscriminate use of imagery is confusing, but it is not if the context is kept in mind. In a universe of derivation, imitation, and parody, the use of the same symbol on so many levels is inescapable. The relationship between heavenly and infernal architecture is delineated in a small in passage that describes the fall of Mulciber. To have built in heaven high towers, nor did he escape by all the engines, but was headlong sent with his industrious crew to build in hell, the pride and glory of the heavenly towers, where sceptred angels held their residence and sat as princes. Heilbronn, in this preceding article, which you can read in its entirety at your own leisure, will go on to explain the parallels between Dis and the city of God, a heavenly Jerusalem, and indeed, the gates of heaven, the juxtaposition and parallel structures between the inferno and paradise, evident in Milton. Recall back to part one, when Gehenna represents both hell and a physical valley surrounding the city of Jerusalem, both approximate, and yet they are opposed. However, as Milton's Satan and Babel represent ambition, both represent futility, for there is fixity in Dis, and a Christian fate, whether in damnation or salvation. Dante was coming off hot of the heels of Thomas Aquinas, and I'm just going to be emphasizing a segment from the Summa Theologica, but just look at the image on the right. Emphasis on the tower and the aspect of the tower representing an engine of ambition. I don't have the image here, unfortunately. I wasn't that well prepared, but there were often, I think it was Stradanus, who constructed this image of the tower, but the tower are also the circles. And by its very nature, this is actually an inversion of this powerful tower imagery that we see in Milton, i.e. we are not seeing something which is simultaneously representing the Tower of Babel rising to meet the heavens, but rather the tower represents the inversion, it represents the descent, it represents the abyss, and of course, who is immersed in the Lake of Croesus, who is at the bottom of the rotten pockets, it is Satan himself. Pandemonium rests at the end. Dis represents a funnel hurling towards the utmost sort of pits in the abyss, and so many references to hell as representing oblivion. So it is a tower, it is ambition, and yet with its inversion, it becomes fixed futility. And now I come to the Summa Theologica. There are said to be many entities, according as many share in eternity by the contemplation of God. The fire of hell is called eternal only because it never ends. Still there is change in the pains of the lost according to the words, to extreme heat they will pass from snowy waters. Hence in hell true eternity does not exist, but rather time according to its text of the psalm, there time will be for ever. Your vine is cut down, it is burnt with fire, at your rebuke your people perish. The distinction between time and eternity, which Thomas Aquinas is drawing for here, is that eternity is an aspect of God, and thereby to include eternity in a description of hell would necessarily include that hell, of course, is attached to God. But of course, as we know, hell represents, if anything else, it represents the antithesis of God. It represents an absence of God's love, the rejection of the beatific vision. Indeed, communication with God becomes inaccessible. And so what is left but time, time that will be forever. On the structure of the city itself and the remaining circles, where the city represents this hellish dominion, and of course it represents nothing less than an eternal prison. The eight deadly sins combined, as we saw earlier, to acedia or sloth in action from Pope St. Gregory, therefore formed to combine the nine circles. And this roughly corresponds to the sins of incontinence or mortal sins. The acedia and the eight deadly sins, despite them forming the structure of the nine circles, and thereby one would assume that each circle is dedicated to a particular sin. This is not the case in Dante. Rather, these, the deadly sins instead, are inscribed to the first through down to the fifth circles. So when moving beyond that here, beyond the sixth circle, we come to the seventh and the eighth circles, and they represent the sins that cry to heaven for vengeance, or peccata clementia in Latin. Those particularly connected to the mark of Cain in the book of Genesis, blood moving on to sodomy, perversions of sex, oppression and fraud. And finally, at the ninth, is the sin of treachery. And the sin of treachery is used here rather than the supreme sin, of course, which is blasphemy. And of course, here treachery is used explicitly to reference the ultimate traitor within the classical sense, which is Brutus. And the man most responsible for betraying Christ, God, Judas, and indeed the spiritual entity, the angel turned demon responsible for betraying God, which of course, as we know with Milton, is Satan. Dante is already greatly indebted to the book of Jerome from the Bible to derive this scriptural inspiration for his ninth circle. And this is reading from Jerome 8. And thou shalt say to them, thus saith the Lord, shall not he that felleth rise again? And he that is turned away, shall he not turn again? Why then is the people in Jerusalem turned away with a stubborn revolting? They have laid hold on lying, and have refused to return. I attended and hearkened, no man speaketh what is good. There is none that doth penance for his sin, saying, what have I done? They are all turned to their own course as a horse rushing into battle. The kite in the air knoweth her time. The turtle and the swallow and the stork have observed the time of their coming, but my people have not known the judgment of the Lord. How do you say, we are wise, and the law of the Lord is with us? Indeed, the lying pen of the scribes hath wrought falsehood. The wise men are confounded, they are dismayed and taken. For they have cast away the word of the Lord, and there is no wisdom in them. Therefore I will give their women to strangers, their fields to others for an inheritance, because from the last even to the greatest all follow covetousness, from the prophet even to the priest all deal deceitfully. And they healed the breach of the daughter of my people disgracefully, saying, peace, peace, when there was no peace. They are confounded, because they have committed abomination. Yea, rather, they are not confounded with confusion, and they have not know how to blush. Therefore shall there fall among them the fall that fall in their time of their visitation, they shall fall, saith the Lord. Gathering I will gather them together, saith the Lord. There is no grape on the vines, and there are no figs on the fig tree. The leaf is fallen, and I have given them the things which are passed away. Why do we sit still, Assemble yourselves, and let us enter into the fenced city, and let us be silent there. For the Lord our God hath put us to silence, and hath given us waters of gall to drink, for we have sinned against the Lord. We looked for peace, and no good came, for all time of healing, and behold fear. The snorting of his horse was heard from Dan. All the land was moved at the sound of the neighbouring neighing of his warriors. And they came and devoured the land and all that was in it, the city and its inhabitants. For behold, I will send among you serpents, basilisks, against which there is no charm, and they shall bite you, saith the Lord. My sorrow is above sorrow, my heart mourneth with me. Moving on from that very gripping imagery, which again represents this whole idea of futility and prison to be herded together. And indeed, in terms of Dante and Crocus, we come to the water becomes ice, and that itself becomes the prison. But having mentioned deception, treachery, and the sins essentially which cry out to heaven, what is the sixth circle? It doesn't represent sins of incontinence. It represents an awkward limbo. You can say it's in some ways the parallel to acedia, but then again, perhaps not. For flames were scattered round among these tombs. The pits, therefore, so intensely fired, no tradesman needs his brand iron half so hot. The covers of the tombs all stood half raised, and out of reach there came such cruel lamenting. And must have been the cries from pain within, and I to my master, who can these all be, these people buried in these sepulchres? They make their presence felt in such pain sighs. The answer, these are the master heretics. Heresy, the excommunicate, separated from Mother Church, is an active sin versus the sin of incontinence. It is an act which separates one from Mother Church that creates the schismatics. It is, again, vis-a-vis acedia, which represents supreme inaction. Within the circle, Dante includes the Epicureans, and they are featured here not among the pre-Christian virtuous pagans. They are non-virtuous, because for Dante, they represent the folly of believing that the soul dies with the body. And this, again, is completely consistent with a Christian conception of the soul, that, of course, the Epicureans should be denied heaven because of their folly, because of the denial of the soul, because, of course, the essence of Catholicism is faith, hope, and charity. These are the three highest virtues. And so without faith, without hope, without belief in the eternal soul, of course, that in itself is going to damn you. And of course, even going forwards, looking at fide, or looking at Lutheranism and soli fide, that salvation lies in faith alone. All of these things are conducive to the idea that when one rejects that the soul is eternal, it isn't simply an intellectual assertion that the soul simply dies with the body, but that statement in itself, that thought, visits upon you damnation. More revealing is that Dante here consigns Frederick II Hohenstaufen, and one Cardinal Octavian, or the antipope of Frederick Barbarossa, Victor IV, to the Circle of Hell, because they were both Ghibelline partisans. As for why Dante would consider this, Frederick II, of course, was known for his rather heterodox views on Christianity, his opposition, repeated opposition to the popes, his desire to form a dominion over Italy from his base in Sicily, and the fact that he used to employ Muslim bodyguards, essentially for the benefit that the Pope could not excommunicate his Muslim bodyguards, and in turn the emperor would be slain by them. The Cardinal Octavian represents the same conundrum, essentially, that he is a master heretic in the sense that he was a pope put up against another pope. And it's all the more interesting that Dante is writing this within the context of what will become the budding Avignon papacy. And this will be written some 50 years before the Western Schism, where we see at times two popes, and at the end of this Western Schism, three popes. So in some senses, he is eliciting this idea of what is actually is to represent the idea of a master heretic, yet also he is prophetic in the sense that this is the fate which the church is going to be consigned. Yet, of course, given that these are Ghibelline partisans, it implies a sense that they are rebelling against the rightly constituted authority, which is the Pope. Indeed, the terms Ghibelline and Guelph were perhaps most persuasive at this time during the second half of the 12th century and the first half of the 13th century. Indeed, the fall of Frederick II, the defeat of Manfred, and the regicide of Conradin all happened within the context of Dante's early birth. These were the events essentially that decimated the Ghibelline Pact, led to the Guelphs becoming ascendant, and then the Guelphs dividing into the White Guelphs and the Black Guelphs, and then, of course, Dante is exiled. So it seems very interesting to me that Dante is not so, you can say, historically prejudiced, that he is looking at these characters and he sees in them some form of noble antecedents. He is not elevating someone like Frederick II, who very consciously emulated himself based on the roles of a classical Caesarian emperor, a hero of antiquity. Again, talking about a Christian point of view, Frederick II, of course, who was able to reclaim Jerusalem, but did so apparently dishonorably because he was able to achieve so through diplomacy and not through conquest. This figure is not elevated along with Julius Caesar and the figures essentially held in the first circle with the virtuous pagans, but condemned behind the walls of Dis forever. Nevertheless, against this, Dante will of course consign his Guelph antagonist, Pope Boniface VIII, to a worse fate, but we will see that towards the end. For now, Dante takes us from the sixth circle through the descent into Dis. Ring one, throughout is meant for violent wills, but violent acts may fall upon three persons. And so this ring is shaped and formed in three. To God, to self, to neighbour hurt is done. To persons, of course, but also their possessions, in ways that you will now hear argued out. To those around us, therefore grievous wounds are wrought, by violent hands the things we own ruined by outrage, extortion, or fire. So in the agonies of subring one, in different squads are homicides and thugs, vandals and looters, bandits and brigands. In violence, too, we turn against ourselves or else our own belongings, and thus in subring two, are those, regret now vain, who by their own free will strips off your world or gambles all their competence way, and weeps where properly they should rejoice. Force too is offered to the deity by hearts blaspheming that deny his power else scorn, nature and her great largesse, and so the imprint of the smallest ring falls on the Cahosian bankers as on Sodom and those who speak at the hearts in scorn of God. As for deceit, which gnaws all rational minds, we practice this on those who trust in us, or those whose pockets have no room for trust. Fraud of the second kind will only gash the ligature of love that nature forms, and therefore the great circle too, their nests swarm in hypocrisy, the casting up of spells, impersonations, thievery, crooked priests, embezzlement and pimping, such like scum. Fraud of the other sort forgets no less that love that nature makes them then as well the love particular that trust creates. So in the smallest ring of all, that point within the universe where Satan sits consumed eternally, are traitors every one. Before I move on from that description by Dante, it's important to talk about the various prominent persons who come out within the first five circles. I've already referenced figures like Plutarch and figures like Minos. Indeed, Minos acting as some sort of great judge, the designator of which circle of hell you are going to spend eternity, or rather the rest of your time there fixed. And within the remaining circles, we are introduced to Medusa and the Furies, who are the figures essentially surrounding and accosting you at the gates of Dis. We have figures like the Minotaur, we have Geryon, we have Nimrod, we have Ephialtes, and of course, moving on from various other characters, we culminate at Satan. So in addition to the obvious inspiration in terms of this, you can say the changing sort of physical manifestations of these various creatures or demons from Ovid's Metamorphosis, we then return to Thomas Aquinas and the Summa Theologica. A demon is a spiritual nature, but a spiritual nature is not affected by place. Therefore, there is no place of punishment for demons. Further, man's sin is not graver than the demons, but man's place of punishment is hell. Much more, therefore, is it the demon's place of punishment, and consequently not the darksome atmosphere. Furthermore, the demons are punished with the pain of fire. But there is no fire in the misty atmosphere. Therefore, the dark atmosphere is not the place of punishment for the demons. On the contrary, as St. Augustine says, that the darksome atmosphere is a prison to the demons until the judgment day, again echoing the fate of the Titans after the Titanomachy. The demons are in this dark atmosphere for our trial, although some of them are even now in hell to torment those who have led astray, just as some of the good angels are with the holy souls in heaven. But after the judgment, all the wicked, both men and angels, will be in hell and the good in heaven. With reference to Virgil, on the contrary, in the authority of St. Jerome, quoted above, I answer that man, while in this late of life, as it were, on a road by which he should journey through toward heaven, on this road man is threatened by many dangers, both from within and without. In this way wherein I walked, they have hidden a snare for me, and therefore as guardians are appointed for men who have to pass by an unsafe road, so an angel guardian is assigned to each man, as long as he is the wayfarer. When, however, he arrives at the end of life, he is no longer in need of a guardian angel, but in the kingdom he will have an angel to reign with him, in hell a demon to punish him. So obviously, this latter passage is, I think, obvious as an inspiration to Dante. However, Virgil is not a guardian angel, but Virgil is a guide. Indeed, the guardian angel you can see when it comes to Dante is, of course, the beatific vision. It is Beatrice. But of course, referencing the idea that as every person to be saved is assigned an angel and will reign with the angels in God, the purpose of a demon is there to act as punishment. So as far as Dante is concerned, a demon is assigned to each circle of hell, and the demon is there to punish. The demon essentially is the lord over that sphere of heaven. Indeed, that is the proper place for such a spiritual demonic entity. And combined to the idea of physical transformation and embodiment and allegory, of course, the demon sent to form that punishment aspect is, of course, it becomes the sin, whereby we come to Canto 17 and Geryon, who I've mentioned a bit earlier. Behold the beast who soars with needle tail through mountains, shattering shields and city walls. Behold the beast that stinks out all the world. To me my lord spoke thus, then beckoned up the monster to approach the jutting prow that marked the end of all our marble paths. It came that filthy image of deceit. Its head and trunk it grounded on the shore. It did not draw its tail pace to the bank. The face was that of any honest man. The outer skin, all generosity. Its timber, though, was serpent through and through. Two clawing grabs and hairy to the armpits. Its back and beast and ribcage all tattooed with knot designs and spinning little whirls. No Turk or Tartar wove a finer drape, more many-coloured in its pile or tuft. Nor did Arachne thread such tapestries. Compare or foreshores, sometimes dinghies stand in water partly, partly on the shingle, as likewise in the land of drunken Germans beavers will do advancing their attack. So did this beast, the worst that there can be, there on the rocky rim that locks the sand, out into emptiness, it swung its tail and twisted upwards its venomous fork. The tip was armed like any scorpion's. Geryon, in Greek mythology, is the grandson of Medusa as a humanoid giant with three heads. per Hesiod, though sometimes descriptions attribute to him three bodies and even wings. Dante's Geryon is a creative invention bearing the same name, the serpentine lord of fraud, the master to which essentially fraudsters are punished, though Dante and his travails bear a superficial resemblance, again going back to the role of the guardian angel assigned, to Geryon's role in the labours of Hercules. So here Geryon is taken as one of Hercules' obstacles, and he is turned into a demon presiding over the seventh circle. Just to elaborate on this, I'm reading from John Frecaro's contribution to the Cambridge Companion. Whatever the moral intent, Geryon is exquisitely literary. His various motifs form a patchwork whose seams Dante scarcely bothers to conceal. Elements of the monster's composition are drawn from the apocalypse, or perhaps from the lunar dragon of the astrologers, from which the dragon of the apocalypse probably derives. Scholars have suggested various classical sources for the image as well, notably from Virgil and Salinas. Apart from in its thematic function, however, its literary central position in the Inferno and the elaborate address to the reader introducing it suggests it was also meant to stand for the poet's own prodigious imagination. Throughout the story, the progress of the pilgrim is, at the same time, the progress of the poem. Here too, perhaps, Geryon is both the theme and in Aristo's Hippograph, a self-conscious emblem of the poet's creative act. Aristo's fantastic steed is an obvious descendant of Pegasus, said to have sprung from Medusa's blood. That chthonic origin would qualify Pegasus as an ancestor of Geryon as well. Chthonic, meaning sort of from the, literally sort of from the blood, albeit in some sort of references, sort of land from the blood and all that sort of thing. The flight on Geryon seems to call forth as its antithesis the ship of Ulysses or Odysseus, sailing to disaster. Both Geryon and Ulysses are recalled in the course of the poem. Ulysses is referred to twice in the Purgatorio and once in the Paradiso, while Virgil refers back to this flight as his claim to the pilgrim's continued faith in his guidance, even through purgatorial fire. His reminder to Dante, "Did I not guide you safely on the back of Geryon?" recalls Exodus 19:4, "You saw how I bore you up on the eagle's wings." This is just a note, because I'm sure many people will be able to assume this, and I might even get one comment on this. But notice how the image of the fiery tower, the image of the black gates, which are present in both Dis and in Pandemonium, all of these things are obviously incredibly sort of rich inspirations to any sort of Tolkien studies enthusiast, because the same languages and the same imagery and creativity is replicated within Tolkien. Indeed, on the one hand, when it comes to the figure of Geryon, Geryon, of course, represents a fell beast on the one hand, but recalling back to Exodus, you see how I bore you on the back of eagle's wings. So, of course, not only does this represent the inversion, which are the eagles within Lord of the Rings, which are the sentinels of Manwë, which in themselves essentially act as some sort of aspect of heavenly intervention, but who, of course, is bearing them on the back of the eagle's wings. And in this sense, Virgil would become Gandalf. But anyway, moving on from that tangent. The flight of Geryon is described with navigational imagery, while the navigation of Ulysses is described with a memorable phrase in terms of the flight, il folle volo. This symmetrical opposition is reinforced by antitypes. The successful flight of Geryon evokes allusions to Icarus and Phaeton. By Icarus and Phaeton, of course, Icarus creates a pair of wings along with his son to fly out of captivity, with the notion that one doesn't fly too close to the sun or too close to the sea. And of course, Icarus' son plunges to his death. As with Phaeton, he was the underling of the god Helios. The god Helios, the god of the sun, whose role was to carry the sun across his chariot to represent the passing of the day. Phaeton usurped that position, crashed the chariot, and in so doing created the Sahara Desert, according to Greek mythology. While Ulysses is introduced by a comparison to the successful flight of Elijah, of course, of Elijah ascending to heaven in a chariot, the chariot of fire. This parallelism suggests that the two journeys exist on the same level of significance as dramatic representations of opposing attempts to reach the absolute. Because the voyage is also a figure for the writing of the poem, as is clear in the invocations to the second and last canticles, as well as from the narrative logic that makes the journey's end the poem begin. The contrast between Ulysses and Geryon is also a contrast between literary genres. The Homeric story has been interpreted since antiquity as an allegory of the soul's education. The disastrous conclusion of the story in Dante's revised version amounts to a Christian critique of philosophical presumption, specifically of the claim that anyone could accomplish such a journey without a guide. And again, talking about Milton, the idea of man assuming wings and being able to fly up the creation of the Tower of Babel to create a dominion over all of the world without God's grace. Again, one essentially professes in the Confiteor, the confession, when one's gravely sinned. You add to that the idea of one is a poor sinner in every single essence. One is in need of saving. One is in need of a savior. Going back to Summa Theologicum, the idea of one being assigned a guardian angel, a guide, all of these things are intrinsic to the Christian worldview. The flight on Geryon, on the other hand, is providentially guided like God's eagle in Exodus. It is a descent that precedes an ascent. Again, like the harrowing of the hell precedes the assumption. With the Augustinian admonition, descend so that you may ascend. And of course, that is also an obvious allusion to repentance. Moreover, it takes place in the inner space of hell, which may be said to stand for the interior distance of a descent within the self. Once more, Augustine comes to mind. Do not go outside, but enter within yourself. This inner dimension is totally lacking in Ulysses' account of his journey. He may be thought of as an archetypal explorer in outer space, describing his feat with the same understatement used by American astronomers when they landed on the moon, one small step for man. The voyage for all such voyages are the stuff of epic. In contrast, Dante's journey on the Geryon of his own experience is a descent into himself. Such a turning inward is distinctly confessional. As we saw at the beginning, before the coming to the gates of Dis, he was accosted by the wrathful spirit of Albertini, and Dante considers about withdrawing out of himself, or rather essentially departing this exploration of hell, which is also an exploration into himself. There's an aspect of self-awareness here. No. Dante decides to proceed essentially and understand the full extent of human depravity. The bizarre vehicle of Dante's descent into the Malabolga, or the rotten pockets in the Kirkpatrick translation, which I'm using, is neither ship nor chariot in the tradition of Neoplatonic allegory, although it bears a grotesque resemblance to those flights of the soul. The surly beast might be compared to the horse veering to the left in the allegory of the Phaedrus, while the navigational imagery in Geryon's flight, like the flight of imagery in Ulysses' navigation, is reminiscent of allusions to the flights of the soul in Plotinus, Ambrose, or Augustine, where the means of escape from this world are compared to horses, chariots, ships, and wings. However, it is providence rather than a charioteer who reigns in Geryon, and it is fraud rather than passions that must be dominated. This flight does not take place in an interior void, but rather in the course of Dante's life, reinterpreted from the perspective of hell. Geryon adds to the Neoplatonic tradition a political dimension of the meaning. One is enjoined not simply to escape the hypocrisy and fraud of human society, as encapsulated in Geryon, as Plotinus has urged, but to understand it from within, so one can transcend it. This is the social significance of Virgil's warning. Understanding in the Inferno is a process that must be characterized as a hyperbolic doubt, systematically applied to the values of contemporary society. Each encounter in hell amounts to the ironic undercutting of the values enunciated in the separate characters. Even when those values seem perfectly defensible from a human point of view, as is the case, for example, with the humanistic aspirations expressed by Brunetto Latini in Canto 15, the values are undermined by the fact of being championed by the damned, an incidental phrase meant as political qualification. Brunetto becomes charged with irony as the infernal context exposes it as obvious, therefore cruel rejoinder. If his discernment were acute, why would he be here? Brunetto and all of these interesting sort of figures representing this, it doesn't matter how necessarily profound one philosophy, like going back to the master heretics as well, how innovative or how original. All of this comes back to, you can even say, the Kavala and the idea of the creator and the sub-creator, the old master and the youth, essentially, who wants to create his own tune, his own song. Innovation, ideas, genius, all of these things aren't enough if they're basically done in opposition to the creator, or indeed in spite of the creation, as is the case with Satan. We are all invited to become sub-creators. So obviously I sort of have to harp back on and take that note, which is explicitly sort of evident in Tolkien. This corrosive irony gives the Inferno its negative quality. Not only in this canticle devoid of redemptive possibilities, it seems devoid of all affirmations as well. The goal of the descent is to reach the zero point from which the climb to the Purgatorio can begin. In order to do this, it is necessary first to strip away all the illusory values with which we ordinarily comfort ourselves. In Plato's myth, the star soul has to shed all of its layers of materiality in order to return to its celestial home. In the Christian myth, it is sin rather than matter that weighs down the soul. Before any ascent can begin, it is necessary to go through hell simply to reach the cave, which Plato assumed to be the point of departure. Christian ascent begins not from a point zero, but rather from a minus point. In the poem, that point is described in the prologue scene. The landscape is derived from what Augustine would call the region of unlikeness, the hostile forest. The primary destruction that must take place in this mythic representation of biography is the destruction of the poet's former self. If Plato's myth of education is the account of morphosis, the formation of the soul, then the story of the conversion is a metamorphosis, again looking obviously back to Ovid, in which an illusory self must be destroyed before a new soul can take its place. One of the ways in which this destruction takes place in the poem is through a series of ironic autocitations in which Dante undercuts his own previous work. The most obvious of these is the citation of the earlier love poetry placed in the mouth of Francesco di Rimini, who was ill-served by the theory of the love and gentle heart, but is perhaps the Canto of Ulysses that constitutes Dante's most important and most critical autocitation. According to a hypothesis first advanced by one Bruno Nardi, there is a certain parallelism between the attempt of Ulysses to reach the absolute and Dante's attempt in the Convivio to outline a guide to happiness through the pursuit of secular philosophy. Both attempts were, of course, doomed to failure. The parallel between this failure and the experience of Augustine was first pointed out by one Giorgio Padoan, who showed how Augustine, in the Beata Vita, outlined the disastrous course of his life, including his search for happiness through secular philosophy, in terms of a tedious allegory based on the voyage of Ulysses. He suggested that the episode of Ulysses in the Inferno is biographical in the same way that Augustine's prologue to the Beata Vita was biographical. This is an allegorical outline of an experience in which the literary elements are suppressed. The voyage of Dante's Inferno of the Divine Comedy begins where the shipwreck of Ulysses ends, with the survival of the metaphoric shipwreck. The survival marks the difference between Dante's own evil presumption and his novelistic conversion. We can only speculate about the details of Dante's own life experience, for the text provides us only with figures such as these. In a sense, no experience could be conveyed except by a figure, since acceding to a medieval maxim, what is individual is ineffable. Allegory and other figures serve to generalize experience so that it can be communicated. From this, we arrive to Geryon transporting to the Malabog, or the Rotten Pockets, the Funnel of the Depths. So, of course, that's already been alluded to, but I'm now reading that direct passage. There is in hell a place called the Rotten Pockets. Rock, all rock, its colour rusted iron. As is in the wall that circles all around, dead in the centre of that poisoned plain, a well yawns open, empty, broad and deep. Of that, when it's convenient, I'll have my say. For now, between the well mouth and the clench of cliff, a circling belt goes round its floor, divided into 10 deep trenches. Compared to guard the outer walls of castle moats, the concentric multiples are dug and form the figure of a wheel around them. That was the pattern that these trenches made, and where from fortresses pontoons run out to link each threshold to the other shore, so at the bottom of the precipice, radicals ride over every bank and ditch, till, at the pit, they stop and then are sucked in. This was the place shaken from the spine of Geryon, where we found ourselves. And one can't sort of look at the Rotten Pockets and the description by Dante and almost view Dis, even if you look at the Stradanus image on the right, that Dis is essentially as a form of quicksand consuming those who fall in it. The Malabolga, the Rotten Pockets, divided into 10 bulgas or trenches. For the first, there are the seducers, and then there are the obsequious, who have been submerged in rivers of excrement. And of course, it should be obvious that the excrement is supposed to represent an allegory for the non-substance or the complete and utter lack of substance, which is indicative in their flattery. But from Canto 19, Dante introduces the figure, which I was alluding to earlier on, which of course is Pope Boniface VIII, who is placed here among the simoniacs, i.e. those who have committed the sin of simony, which is to sell off ecclesiastical offices in the third trench. Whatever you might be there upside down, staked your unhappy spirit like a pole, if you, I said, are able, then speak out. So there I stood, like any friar who shrives the hired assassin head down in the earth, who calls him back to put off stifling death, and he yelled out, is that you standing there? Are you there on your feet still, Boniface? The writings lie to me by quite some years. Are you so sick of owning things already? Till now you hardly have been afraid to cheat our lovely woman, tearing her to shreds. Well, I just stood there. You will know just how. Simply not getting what I'd heard come out. Feeling a fool, uncertain what to say. Then Virgil entered. Say this and make speed. No, that's not me. I am not who you think, and so I answered as he should, as I should, at which all feet the spirit thrashed about, then sighing loudly in a tearful voice. So what is it you want of me, he said, if you're so keen to know who I might be, and ran all down the slope to find me out. You better know I wore the papal cope, a true Orsini, son of Ursa Bear. I show such greed in favouring her brats, that up there, well, in pocket, I'm in pocket here. Below me, in great stacks beneath my head, packed tight in every cranny of the rock, are all antecedents of the Simon line. Down there I'll sink in the same way, when he arrives who I'm supposed that you might be, and uttered therefore my abrupt inquiry. But I already, feet upon the grill tossed, upside down have passed more time, than Boniface yet will, stuck here with red-hot toes. For after him, from westward they'll appear, that lawless shepherd uglier indeed, who then for both of us will form a lid. He shall be known as Jason once again. We read in Maccabees, priest bribes a king. This other will score well one with one French prince. I may have been plain mad. I do not know But now, in measured verse, I sang these words. Tell me, I pray. What riches did our Lord demand at first instalment from St. Peter before he placed the keys in his command? Obviously, Peter's keys, the keys to the kingdom of heaven, but also to the papacy. He asked, be sure, no more than come behind me. Of course, in reference to Christ's Lent in the desert. Nor did St. Peter or the rest of them receive from Matthias a gold or silver piece, allotting him the place that Judas lost. So you stay put, you merit punishment, but keep your eye on ill-gotten coin that may you bold with Charles the Angevin. And were I not forbidden, and I am by reverence of those keys supreme and holy, that you hung on to an happy life, and now would bring still weightier words to bear, you and your greed bring misery to the world, trampling the good and raising up the wicked. It's interesting to note again, in the grand scheme, you can say, of Dante's patriotism, his Italian nationalism, and indeed his sympathy for Henry VII, he's focusing specifically on Boniface VIII's relationship with Charles of Naples, Dominus Charles, who was essentially responsible indirectly, along with Boniface VIII, for Dante's exile, having served as a city prior. So what Dante essentially does, you know, in contrast to the quick sort of flitting with Cardinal Octavian and Frederick II in the Sixth Circle, here Boniface VIII is given a long denouncement at the hands of Dante. And of course, this within the context of Boniface VIII already being still alive at the point of this composition, that even before he has died, he has already been condemned by Dante to the eighth circle among the Simonists. So on the one hand, Dante is able to gain a victory over Boniface VIII for the sake of posterity, for the sake that the fame of the Inferno will far forever supersede that of the pontificate of Boniface VIII. But of course, as I was alluding to earlier, with regards to the prophetic aspects of Dante, Boniface VIII, within the whole scheme of Simony in the church, and indeed referencing specifically the family Orsini, is again rather minor. Rather, Dante's accusation again is that he was too willing to take money and bribes from Angevin Charles, Charles Dominus. Essentially, the idea that he was nothing more of the pawn of foreign powers, in this case, the pawn of the French. But of course, before then, we have the pornocracy, we have the Saeculum Saeculorum. Now, surely the figures who would be more appropriate, other than for the sake of Dante's sort of owner satisfaction in an autobiography, would be the Theophylacti. And indeed, in terms of recurring this back to the prophetic elements of the end, we have to be reminded of the Babylonian captivity, the Western schism, that of the master heretics and the conflicts between popes and anti-popes, and bringing this forward to the reconciliation of the papacy under Martin V, and ultimately the ascent of the Renaissance popes and all the aspects associated with that, be simony, the proliferation of cardinal nephews, etc. Indeed, the use of the papacy essentially as a secular office to establish familial dominions within Italy, within the papacy. Most nominally, of course, we always think of the Borgias when coming to that, and Cesare essentially being ascended to that of the Prince of the Romagna. But I think it was perhaps more appropriate to attribute that to the Della Rovere family and Julius II, who was also the man most responsible for the demonization of his predecessor's legacy. So, having arrived at the rotten pockets before really coming to Satan, and using that really as a means to describe Satan and Croctus in full, along with the rest of the eighth circle, I'm going to leave it there for part two. So thank you very much, everyone, for listening.